and welcome to another episode of the Crossbox Podcast, this being our November edition, and I would like to state for the record that we are recording this in November, so it does count as our November edition.
Yep, that's right. Yep.
Well, I am your host, Jay. I am joined by my co-host,
John.
And I suppose just dive right into the news today.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get on with it.
All right, so we'll even get the vamp for a bit while I get the timer out.
That's true, right? I mean, you know, last time, you know, we don't have anything really special this time today. You know, we did some goofy stuff last time. We're just kind of shooting the breeze. We do have a segment like that, but we're back to our standard format. While my co-host here, you know, fusses with the timer.
I mean, it's very important.
Yep. And we actually have a Christmas special planned for you in December that will be a little different, but hopefully quite fun.
Yes.
And by hopefully, I really don't care. I'm grumpy that way.
We'll do our best. Anyway, so I'll put myself on the clock here for 1 minute and dive into my news item. You want to count me down?
3, 2, 1, and go.
Well, we have more news of the Zumwalt-class destroyer. In continuing evidence that naval architecture is hard, filed under Seawater likes to get where it isn't supposed to be.
What?
I know, right? We have yet another engineering casualty for USS Zumwalt, joining one we heard about in September and one we only kind of heard about in October, which makes it, you know, a pace of about one per month, which is not a great pace for your warship to have.
No.
Anyway, so what happened was it was transiting the Panama Canal toward San Diego, and seawater got into the bearings which connect the electrical motors to the drive shafts. And the shafts lock because seawater is not oil, and suddenly we have a crash stop. Literally, they hit the side of the canal. Actually, the canal wall, which is, you know, not great.
Maybe we could ask the Titanic's designers about water getting where it oughtn't be.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. Anyway, so this isn't the first problem we've had with seawater, and I think in future podcast topics, have we talked about how procurement is hard yet? Because that should be something.
No, we haven't done a good procurement is hard marathon, possibly in the new year.
Yes, that just about wraps up my time.
Very well.
Let me prepare yours. What do you have for us today?
Well, I'm going to be talking about the Glockalypse.
Ready?
Oh yeah, go right. I just wanted to get one of my Glocks and set it on the table in front of me.
In 3, 2, 1.
Go. All right. So the Glockalypse continues. And the Glockalypse, of course, is the massive shakeup kind of ushered in by Glock with, you know, their wonderful polymer-framed handgun, which checks a lot of boxes. It's reasonably reliable, reasonably accurate, very cheap to make, and they can sell it at a great price. Well, announced in time for Thanksgiving, CZ over in the Czech Republic, almost said Czechoslovakia there,
Czechia, I think they prefer these days.
Whatever. The Czechs have released their own polymer-framed, striker-fired handgun.
What, another one?
Yes, exactly. They're getting in on the fun with H&K, Walther. Beretta's got one coming, though it's not here yet. And this is just, you know, and I'm not quite sure I see the merit. I mean, on the one hand, I love my Glocks. On the other hand, Glock's got that market sewed up. It's super easy to get stuff from my Glock.
So-called Glock brand Glock.
Exactly. And so I'm just not quite sure I see, you know, what yet another one brings to the table. But maybe I'm wrong.
I suppose time will tell.
That's right.
Which I think we say that after the news an awful lot.
Yeah. Well, this is, you know.
But it's usually the case.
Right. But I will leave you with this, dear listeners. If anyone says it's a Glock killer, in air quotes there, it's killer with an A.
A-H, I think.
Yeah, killer, A-H. You can laugh at them because we have a whole long litany of Glock killers that have not dethroned Glock. And the FBI has, in fact, just chosen Glock.
Yes.
To replace their Glocks. So for the foreseeable future, I think Gaston's empire is pretty safe.
Seems reasonable to me. Yeah. As much as I like the idea of having hammers on my pistols.
All right. Yeah, that's to each his own, right? Mm-hmm. But I think the interesting thing for me was that CZ is really well known for making really good hammer-fired guns. Yeah.
It's kind of strange to them jumping on the bandwagon, I guess. But
right.
That's the thing about bandwagons. People love to give them a good jump.
Yeah. I mean, interestingly, CZ is the other popular brand other than Glock for production in USPSA and IPSC that's popular. So basically, if you're winning in production or limited, you're often using a highly modded Glock 34, like the one in front of me, which actually isn't all that modded, or a CZ, you know, 75 derivative, like the Shadow 2, which is supposed to be coming sometime, maybe eventually.
Yes.
It's actually a gun that is too cool for Jay, So he can't actually own one. He's very sad. He's making a sad face right now.
Not really at all. I'm actually smiling that I have not been taken in by the modern trend. I remain comfortable in my historical superiority.
That's right. I mean, if it's good enough for, what's his name? Riggs in Lethal Weapon, it's good enough for Jay.
I was going to go with John Moses Browning.
That works too. Though he didn't really do double action, did he?
Not really, no, but he did do hammers, and I'm a fan of hammers.
Oh, so that's where we're going. Yeah. It just has a hammer. I'm going to take like a, what I should do, well, see, were Glocks cheaper, I would get a Glock, or if I get them for what Glock pays to make them, I'd get a Glock, duct tape a hammer to it. So here, it has a hammer.
Nah, it doesn't move. It's got to move.
Well, you make a duct tape and swingy bit. All right. Enough of that. We're getting digressing here, and we do have an agenda, sort of.
We do have an agenda. I think the first item on that agenda is a defense topic, and it's a defense topic that is near and dear to a certain defense blogger's heart who has kind of fallen out of favor with us, the Soapbox contributors, ever since we started doing our own defense blogging.
Right.
And that is Sven of Defense and Freedom. Yep. I'll let you introduce this one, John, because I think you feel more strong than I do.
Sven is an interesting guy. If you're listening, Sven, guten Tag. He's out of Germany. He's got a lot of interesting ideas, some of which I kind of like, some of which I like to chuckle at, and my co-contributor here agrees with me. But the one that comes up a lot and makes me chuckle the most is the tactical motorcycle. Excuse me. Das tactical motorcycle.
Oh, yeah.
I can't do a very good bad German accent, but that's going to have to do.
Close enough.
So the concept here is presumably inspired by the Wehrmacht, the last time anyone was terrified of the Germans.
We're perhaps going back even further, the bicycle infantry.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Of World War One. Yes.
Well, and even of World War Two at the beginning.
Belgians. Terrifying powers, those. And the idea is that...
I'm not saying they were good. I'm just saying they were also in World War II.
Right. Yeah. For all, like, you know, 2 months of it, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea here is that we need to move soldiers rapidly. And the cheapest way to do this is with small, lightweight motorcycles.
Yeah.
And there are so many problems with this that I don't quite know where to start.
Okay, see, I have exactly one sentence, which I think serves, at least for me, to demolish the whole idea.
Yes.
That sentence is this following sentence. It does zero things better than a quad.
That's very true, actually.
Yeah.
Now, see, I've written...
Well, let me... I'll elaborate briefly. So,
yeah.
A motorcycle is self-evidently harder to ride than a quad, especially off-road.
Yes.
It is... that's the big one. You can't put as much onto a motorcycle because, again, it's difficult to ride and the weight distribution matters a lot more than if you have four wheels.
Right.
Like on some sort of perhaps four-wheeled vehicle.
Small and light.
Roughly square. We could call it like a quad or something.
Right. I don't know where you're going. I couldn't possibly tell where you're going with that.
Yeah.
That's I think like the first problem is that he's kind of ignoring quads and possibly it's a German. Do they have quads in Germany? I don't know. German listeners, write us and tell us whether or not you know what a quad is and do you have them? Because I've ridden actually both quads.
What do you mean squares? Of course we have squares.
I've ridden both a quad and a dirt bike, and the dirt bike was on dirt, of course, in a like a track controlled setting. And the dirt bike is much harder to ride. You wear jeans, you fall a lot. It's tons of fun, but you wear jeans and fall a lot. Mm-hmm. Until you get the hang of it, and it's still kind of shaky. The quad, you can basically get on it and go as long as you're not too much of an idiot about how you drive it.
Right, and you also have a much lower minimum speed.
Correct.
Which is important if you're trying to, you know, go through trees or somewhere off-road where you can't take your larger, more sensible vehicles.
Right. The quad, you know, I've been out hunting with some friends, and the quad is great for, we've killed some deer or some animal, like macho, manly American He-Man, and we really don't feel like lugging this back to our stupid truck. We'll plop it on the back of the quad on the little rack that's built for dead animals, and you just kind of drive it back. Now you have to be a little slower and a little more careful with it because it's got kind of funky weight, but whatever, you can make it work. And again, considering how big packs are, you know, a soldier's pack is, this is an idea that might have merit. There's one other problem I want to bring up with motorcycles that's shared by quads, but at least quads are easy to teach someone to drive.
Yes, they have. Well, they have some practical advantages that motorcycles don't. Anyway, carry on.
So we've seen in Iraq the problem of the improvised explosive device. Now, Iraq is a kind of a unique case, I think. It's very heavily urbanized and with a heavy kind of guerrilla population.
The population's heavily urbanized.
And so you might not... I don't think the IED threat is necessarily one to game out as a massive threat you should lose a lot of sleep over in the future. But urban warfare is going to be a thing in the future. And mines are definitely going to be a thing in the future. Either in an urban setting or out in the field, you know, because you have a wide variety of ways of quickly scattering mines. And motorcycles are basically impossible to protect against any kind of mine.
Yes. Well, see, though that may be true, there is a... like, the very nature of a formation of motorcycles or quads is that it's somewhat more strung out in terms of...
Oh, well, yes. You're trying to trade for dispersion. So you're
using soldiers, I guess, as a blade of armor.
Right, yeah. And the problem
Which plays badly in the home
press. Yes, that's a big problem. The problem with soldiers as a blade of armor is unless you are China, you don't have the manpower. Basically, everyone's gotten rid of conscription. Whether or not that's good, or you think that's a good thing or not, that's the case. Conscription's gone. It's dead. Deader than Kennedy. Any Kennedy. Right? So conscription's gone, so you have very limited manpower. You've spent a lot of effort in training these men, equipping them, getting them to be the scary, terrifying forces they are today. And you also have press. And as we've seen, actually, you know, and a lot of people say, oh, it's just the Western media, it's the evil CNN. No, it's not. You can actually see in the Ukraine, Russian casualties play very badly in the Russian media. And the Russian mother's voting bloc is pretty awful. That's like a pretty tough one to work with. And so, look, Russia has to deal with the fact that they can't take the kind of casualties they used to be able to take. And maybe things like body armor, things like protected vehicles are actually kind of more the way to go. And again, the thing with both the IED threat and the mine is that this might be a little overblown, but the idea is you can't actually say where a safe area is unless you've driven through it yourself in the past hour. Mm-hmm. You don't know. Has someone come by last night and buried, like, you know, 3 155 shells, you know, under that pile of dirt? Right? Has somebody come in with a truck or a helicopter or a shell and just scattered a bunch of, you know, mines here?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of things to play, and I just don't see what the motorcycle gets you. I'm also kind of confused, admittedly, because
it's cool, yeah.
That must be it, right? With those high leather boots,
yeah,
and the jodhpurs and the big peak caps and black. It's a very slimming color.
Yeah, it's good nighttime camouflage.
Oh, exactly.
Unlike, you know, motorcycle engines,
right, which are loud and kind of obnoxious. And I think the other...
There's another fast problem. I bet the unit noise per soldier in a motorcycle battalion is much, much, much higher when they're on the march, yeah, than for something equipped with, like, your armored personnel carriers.
Right. And actually, I'd really be concerned about maintenance costs. Again, for your hypothetical motorcycle battalion versus a conventional motorized or mechanized battalion, mm-hmm, how do your maintenance costs, you know, shake out in terms of time and effort spent? In terms of repairing,
there is a lot of small things to maintain.
And right,
engines do go, like, have a way of going wrong.
Right, they do. And you've got a lot.
It's kind
of
like, it's to draw from our IT experience. It's kind of like a large array of consumer hard drives. So,
right,
where your failure rate is low individually, but high on aggregate. So you spend, right, a lot of time, like, rebuilding things,
swapping drives. And that's miserable. What do IT centers use, kids? Enterprise hard drives that, you know, don't break as much.
Except for my backup provider. They have, like, a fancy system for, like, their storage units are basically like these big giant rack mount things. I think they just, if one of them has a failure, they just swap the whole one out and put, like, the backup one in, then fix the other one and then hot swap it back.
Interesting. So, yeah.
Backblaze, they treated me well. They're not paying me to say this.
I concur.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't realized. I hadn't looked in their storage how they do things, but that's cool.
Yeah.
But in general, though, we see a lot more enterprise solutions, and I think you'd get, you know, whether your poison is BMPs or Bradleys or Pumas, mm-hmm, you'd get a much better return on, you know, a vehicle for a larger vehicle.
Which again, just comes down to the, like you were saying, the kind of the enterprise tipping point, I guess, beyond which it makes sense to buy the expensive IBM/General Dynamics solution as opposed to the one you can get off the rack at your local Harley dealer or Newegg, to complete the metaphor.
Exactly. And actually, I think the other thing, too, is that you'd really need a certain kind of motorcycle engine. I think Sven, you know, we've mocked a bunch here, but he's got his head like, you know, kind of a really old BMW motorcycle, which doesn't exist anymore. The kind of old BMW or Harley that, you know, okay, a reasonably handy dude with, you know, a couple wrenches and a hammer could keep going. Well, okay, those reasonably handy dudes are in old folks' homes now. people of our generation tend not to be super handy with small engines. Small engines are super complicated.
Well, nowadays, yeah. Yeah.
When your dad wants to fix his car motorcycle, he used to be able to do it with a couple wrenches and a hammer. Now, you go down to auto parts, you get, like, you know, a box, you plug it in, replace a box.
Yeah.
All right? There's a couple things that are user serviceable, but mostly, you know, it's big hot spots. Because it's easier for everyone, except the motorcycle battalion, to have things that are rapidly field, you know, that aren't really field serviceable. It's no, you replace the whole system.
Yeah.
Just deal with it at the factory.
Yeah.
You rip out these things, you swap these electric boxes, or you just swap, you know, wholesale large engine components. Mm-hmm.
I think that about covers that topic.
Yeah. So it's just things we don't get, don't do it, it's silly.
Yeah.
You know, this is something else I want to bring up. Because we see this trap a lot with guys who... I think we're both guilty of it sometimes, too, so we're not really pointing fingers. This is the glass house.
Yes.
We're all sinners here. But we try to be, as, you know, armchair defense analysts, we try to, you know, bring value to our blog by doing things risky and trying to go, you know, be the next, you know, Basil Liddell Hart.
Yeah.
But I think one has to be really careful. If your conclusions are something that's shared by no military anywhere, you just spend a long time looking at that and see, are you missing some big obvious reason why? Because the simple explanation is not that you are Basil Liddell Hart reincarnate and everyone else is wrong. The simple explanation is you're missing something, something big and problematic.
Yes.
Right? So, you know, this is why, you know, I like the concept of a heavy APC. There's a lot of, and I have to admit, there's a lot of problems with it that make it, you know, this is, you know, kind of hard to make, to square and make work.
Right.
Right? There's a reason why IFVs are popular. And, you know, that's an awful lot of firepower to give up. And the calculus, while, you know, on paper, it seems like, no, trading for armor is the right thing to do. You know, in reality, might not be.
I think in the end, it really depends on what you're planning on using them for. And right. I think we've covered this.
Yeah, this is elsewhere, or perhaps a topic for another time. Again,
We'll put that on the list.
Yeah.
Anyway, to go back to something you said before about things we don't get.
It's a wonderful segue.
Yeah. So our next topic is our games topic for the night. We're going to spend some time in the same way that we just ragged on tactical motorcycles. We're going to rag on genres we don't get.
Yep.
And in the interests of fairness, of being fair and balanced to the best of our abilities, well, more or less, we went out and each of us obtained an example of the genres we don't get.
Yep.
So for me, I went out and purchased...
Oh, wait, let's do genre first.
Okay, well... It's a good introduction, I think.
Yeah.
I went out to my favorite gaming forum, and in the giveaway thread there, I saw somebody had a key for Train Sim 2016.
Oh, boy.
And then introduce your...
And for me, I saw... I'm a huge Indiana Jones fan. I mean, who isn't? And I saw on Steam that I could buy the classic adventure game Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. It's about as old as I am, actually. And I could buy that for, on sale, mind you, $1.50.
$1.50?
$1.50 for a game. And I said I couldn't possibly go wrong.
It's hardly anything at all.
Right?
Anyway, so train sims.
Yeah.
Well, we'll throw in, like, truck sims and other transit simulators, too.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of all the same genre.
Yeah. Like, anything that isn't really a flight sim here.
Yeah, or like a racing game.
Yes.
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 So, I actually almost kind of get the idea. And this isn't how we...
Looking very quizzical, ladies.
This isn't how we sold this segment to each other, but what's turned up after my play experience.
Right.
So, John is one of those rare people who is capable of sitting and thinking about nothing.
It's very difficult, but I can do it.
Yes. And see, I am not that person at all. I explained it by saying my brain has a minimum idle speed. And if I want to, like, say, listen to a podcast sitting in a chair, I literally cannot do it because I will start thinking about something else or I'll start doing something else. And then suddenly the podcast, like, I've lost the thread of the podcast conversation. So I do most of my listening to that sort of content, do audio content in the car.
Right.
Because it's... There, like, something requires my attention, but not enough to draw it away from what I'm listening to. And this whole transit sim genre is kind of purpose-made for that.
Okay. I have questions, but I'm going to let you finish.
All right. All right, Kanye. So, yeah. And I think trains also have a, like... I don't know. I guess they're vague.
Trains are cool.
They're vaguely romantic. I mean,
yes. No, like trains are definitely cool.
I recently took a train trip from Pittsburgh to New York, and it was enjoyable.
And it wasn't even a steam train.
Yeah, it's much better than flying, I would say. Yeah. It's about for given routes where you...
Yeah, for shortish, yeah. It's like a short to medium haul.
Yeah. Right. Or if you're going to like make the thing a vacation, but then you probably want something nicer than Amtrak.
Probably.
Yeah.
So here's my question, though. I do want to interject just for a brief moment, because this may help your point in a second. But so you like to listen to your podcasts in the car.
Right.
So 5 work days an average week. How long would you say is your commute to work, approximately up and back?
About 20 minutes each way, so 40 minutes
a week. So you got about 40 minutes a day, all right, and then you've got, 5 days a week.
Right. So, yes, that's quite a bit of time, which I think is what you're getting at. But the thing is, I have, there's more audio content, I think, that I want to listen to than I currently have time to, especially since I'm working my way through the backlog of 1930s style radio drama podcast Decoder Ring Theater.
Excellent.
So, again, that's mostly a justification for the idea of like a relaxing, meditative, air quotes game.
Right.
Anyway, I think trains do have some mystique, which is one point in their favor, like out of the whole constellation of transit sims.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have the benefit of being super easy.
Yeah.
So let's talk about 3 different kinds of a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
An airplane, a car, and a train.
Okay.
How many dimensions does an airplane move in, John?
It moves in 3 dimensions, Jay. And then there's basically a 4th dimension, quote-unquote, for speed.
Right.
So three, four, depending how you want to count.
How many dimensions do cars move in?
Well, they've got 2, plus the 1 for speed.
How many dimensions do trains move in?
1. Speed.
It's basically a line. Yeah. So that's there's not a ton to think about. I mean, somebody else does the navigation.
Mm-hmm.
You literally, in most cases, have, well, maybe like 2 physical controls, but you have 1 control, and that is go faster or go slower.
Right.
Depending on like how much faster you want to go or how quickly you want to go slower.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they're easy. They're like something you can let go in the background. You can like stare out the window and look at the scenery.
Yeah.
It's got some appeal there. Now that said, I do have some problems with the genre leader, the execution of this concept, which I think is like a reasonable concept if you want some time to like to disengage your brain and just look at something pretty, or disengage your brain and listen to something else. So, Train Simulator is, I would say, comically bad in the way that DCS is sometimes, and I will call out a couple of points. That first one being performance and prettiness are inexplicably terrible.
That's like literally, and I think that's even more inexplicable in Train Sim. I mean, there's no engine to speak of. I mean, I don't have to worry about flight physics or stall speeds or engine overheat.
Well, there's a little bit, but it's not hard. It's like you're
several orders of magnitude different there.
You've got like wheel friction and everything. I mean, you could do complicated like internal modeling of, say, steam engines, but they don't.
Right.
Anyway, so it's probably like slightly less pretty than late model Arma 2, I think I would say.
Ooh, yeah, that's cold.
I know.
That is cold.
Well, see, that's the thing. If it were like drive a train through an Arma 3 landscape, mm-hmm. that'd be pretty nice, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fairly pretty game is Arma 3, and yeah. I could get used
or
to that.
Or Rise of Flight.
Yeah, same deal. Rise of Flight breaks down a little bit close to the ground, unfortunately. But then again, so does this. So.
Right. Well, maybe. Yeah.
So anyway, that is really like a terribly sad thing for a train simulator to be ugly, because again, like you're doing it mostly because it's pretty. Like
right.
As you're crossing a graceful viaduct over this French valley, or like climbing through the Alps, you want to look out the window and say, "Wow, that's gorgeous,"
yeah.
As opposed to. There aren't trees like 4 miles away.
Big green blur.
Yep. It's if you're driving a train without your glasses on, say.
Okay. First, I'm going to have to imagine what it would be like if you're wearing glasses, and then I'm going to have
It'd be like driving a train with my glasses on.
All right, let's figure out what that looks like. Oh, yeah, that's really, really blurry. Especially when I try to like focus on something,
it just goes straight
to hell. You've got nothing. Yeah, so this would be kind of awful.
I need those back so I can see the rest of my notes.
You don't.
Anyway, it's also got that problem. Got the little glasses headache there, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Listeners, Jay is basically blind as a bat.
My wife is significantly more blind than I am, so I am not the blindest person that I know.
One-eyed bat.
Yeah. Actually, that's not true. I know somebody who's actually blind.
That's the no-eyed bat.
So anyway, it's also bafflingly poorly documented.
Right.
Like, It does have, I will grant it this, it's got pretty good tutorials for like the basics of how does a train go forward and go backward. And it's not like, it's not necessarily always that straightforward, especially in the case of steam engines, which, you know, have like complicated spinny bits and you've got to like keep water in the boiler and the fire going and everything. But anyway, so it's still
a steam engine.
Yeah.
Well,
like valves and whatnot. Yeah.
They spin.
Yes.
I see.
Which, it's also very soothing, like that.
I see, yes. Yeah. Valve's noise is soothing.
Not the noise, but, like, the fact that they spin. If you haven't guessed, I'm the, out of our old Top Gear trio, I am both Richard Hammond and James May.
So, somehow.
Yeah.
Somehow that works.
Yep. So past those basic tutorials, you have trouble with, like, still fairly basic concepts. Like, if you're moving around in a rail yard, there's a button you have to press to ask the signaler to let you pass a signal. And there's no mention of that anywhere outside of, like, page 200 some of the manual.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Clever.
Yes. Too clever by half, I would say.
Yeah.
Now, I also don't really get the rest of the truck sim, the rest of the transit sim genre. Like, I find, like, I'm fascinated a little bit by American Truck Simulator because, like, there's, again, that, like, mystique of the open road. But that's just kind of, like, a notional thing.
Spend an awful lot of time listening to C.W. McCall, buddy.
I wouldn't actually want to do it, is the thing. Like,
right.
The idea is interesting, but the actual, like, sit down and drive for 2 hours to go from, like, Las Vegas to Bakersfield is not at all exciting to me.
No.
That's not a very not a very exciting drive, I don't think.
Yeah.
So, well, even if it were an exciting drive, though, it's still like you're driving a big, slow truck.
Right.
And I can do that anytime I want to by just going to the U-Haul place up the road and saying, hey, rent me one of your trucks for a day.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you could actually get some use out of it by, like, you know,
moving
putting
something,
things in.
Yeah, and moving them somewhere else.
Right.
As opposed to just moving bits from one place to another, which I suppose is ironic when I'm also talking about how I think train sims aren't, like, completely terrible. But again, that's because it's slightly more escapist than driving a truck. Driving a truck is, like, maybe the second or third most mundane game idea I think I've ever heard of. And,
wow.
Yeah. Well, see, I've got an even more mundane one. There's a game by some Russian developers.
Oh, there's your first problem.
Which is literally a game about driving a normal car around, like, an everyday busy city.
I don't think there's enough vodka in the world to make that exciting.
I know, right?
But I can, like, if
I... And so, like, I kind of get the same thing about the bus sims and all the other, like, the farming simulators. Again, they're just, like, not really very exciting things to do. Like, even less so than driving a train, which only has the two dimensions.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just me. Like, I drive, not a lot, but some every day, and I kind of have my fill of that, I think.
Yeah. Well, also, you know, going back to things you do easily, it'd be even easier for you to get actually a pretty exciting city on account of Pittsburgh being, you know, eight kinds of messed up. You get in your car
and
drive, you know, 20 minutes, like 20 minutes the other direction, and you hit Pittsburgh. And then you drive around there for a while, and so you've had your fill of, you know, people cutting you off one-way streets.
I can literally play that game, well, not for free. Like, I've had to buy a car and I've got to pay for gas, but it's still like...
But those
are
costs that you have otherwise.
I can play that game, air quotes, without spending any extra money that I wouldn't have spent ordinarily besides a little bit of gas to get to and from the city and to drive around when I'm there. Like, and it's also, again, you know, since we haven't quite gotten to photorealism yet in computer games, and especially not in little computer games by Russian developers,
right?
It's much prettier in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. And then also, you know, if you decide you wanted to get out and visit a museum, get some food, whatever, you could.
And it wouldn't just be, like, virtual food. I'd actually have food in my hand.
Right.
I could, like, look at a painting on a real wall. Like a real painting.
You could go to Piranti's and get a giant sandwich, then eat and enjoy your giant sandwich in real life.
Yes. Which, again, is much better than, like,
a
virtual idea. Anyway, so that's me. Like, I understand the idea in the narrow world of train simulators. I don't get it anywhere else. And I do have one final critique. In that the developers of Train Simulator know their audience very well, namely that they're mostly, like, older men. I think it's probably fair to say that the rail fan, train spotter...
Yeah, that's thing. An old guy.
Yeah, that's, like... I did actually... There was one young guy at the Horseshoe Curve in central Pennsylvania on the way to New York, but everyone else was, you know, fairly aged.
Well, you know, it's just like an old guy thing when you get retired, you need something to do, and some men go for golf and some men go for train spotting.
Yeah, which, yeah, it's the perfectly reasonable hobby.
Yeah.
Anyway, so being mostly like older or retired men. They tend to have a fair bit of disposable income and not a ton besides besides grandchildren to spend it on.
Right.
And although grandchildren are expensive, they're not that expensive. So Train Simulator is.
Yes.
So let me describe to you a DLC pack. Mm-hmm. And you can give me a guess at what you think it ought to cost.
All right.
So it's about like 60 or 80 miles of rail between Philadelphia and New York in the Northeast Corridor.
Okay.
Not really any side routes, just the main line from Philly to New York and the scenery associated therewith.
All right.
And like, I think one or two locomotives to like run on those tracks.
All right, well, now, see, I think this should cost something like $2. But since we primed me to say it's something usurious, I'm going to say $15 for my guess.
You're off by, you're at less than half. That's a $39.99 piece of DLC in the world of the
Transformers. That's usurious. That is highway robbery.
Permanent way robbery, I think I said.
Yes, that. Yes, that is absolutely ridiculous.
No, let's try another one. Let's say you have the Northeast Corridor, and
yes,
you want to run something besides the like the low speed stuff that come to the pack. You want to run, say, the Acela.
Okay, just not that high speed, but okay, I want to run
well, the highest speed.
Yeah.
So, but you get there, you get like the locomotive and like a couple of matching car types.
Okay.
What do you think?
30.
Do high that time, actually. Those are only 20.
Oh, that's still ridiculous for what you're paying, because, again, that should really be, like, a couple bucks.
And, again, it's not that complicated a thing to model. This is half the price of a DCS module, which is probably one of the most detailed software simulations of anything you can, as a person can buy.
Right.
And...
yeah, I mean, the only things that, like, top it get much more expensive for legitimate modeling reasons. Yeah. Also,
we're talking about a vehicle that can be captured almost entirely in its weight... its horsepower, and I guess kind of its braking performance, but I'm not sure how much. Well, even then, it's mostly the train that brakes.
Yes.
So basically, it's weight and its horsepower. You need two numbers to build a locomotive, and they're selling that to you for $20.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous. All right. Well,
yeah,
very good.
That about wraps it up.
Okay. Well, I'm going to talk about adventure games. Now, I want to clarify some things. I don't really have a beef with puzzle games. Because those are little self-contained things, and they tend to be very good. This is going to tip my hand a little, but they tend to be very good about setting up a rule system and following them.
Yes.
I'm my mother's an attorney. I'm very much a rules lawyer. I like rules. I like working within rules. I like finding exploits around rules. But a good puzzle game, COGS, for example, is a wonderful example of a fun, cheap little puzzle game. Looks good. Lots and lots of fun. You can play it. For a little bit, you played for a lot, and it's great.
Yeah.
It also, makes sense.
Also, anything by Zachtronics, who brought you, what, Shenzhen IO, as well as Space Game.
Yep. And again, not always my favorite genre, but something I get, something I enjoy. I got a bunch of puzzle games in my library. They're cool.
Mm.
No, I'm talking about classic point-and-click adventure games. And Jay talked about understanding the point, and the only way I can possibly understand the point is with half of a bottle of Russian Standard and trying to put myself back in the head of someone in, like, the early 80s, or I guess the late 80s.
Early 90s. Yeah. Heyday then.
Well, even then, a lot of things start to break down. Because I understand the gaming technology is limited, and you're trying to tell a story much like a BioWare game. Mm-hmm. And I think we can agree that in general, BioWare makes generally good games overall. So, where something like, what's your favorite BioWare game made?
Probably Mass Effect 2.
All right, Mass Effect 2. Now, that's got some things that are in our real world and some things that aren't, that you have to use your imagination, right, for. But it's got guns that are sort of kind of like real guns. And it's got some, magical kind of powers that are, they have a very nice, neat little rule set. They're pretty easy to understand the limitations of. They're very consistent. And you can pretty easily add those into your kind of mental map of how the world works. And there's some sci-fi technology and some things you can do with that technology. But in Mass Effect, you come to a locked door, right? This is a problem to solve. Now, depending on what they're going to let you do, a game like BioWare, maybe you can blow up the door with some explosives or that rocket launcher. Maybe you can use your magic to smash it. Maybe there's a lock you can pick, a computer you can hack. Maybe there's a guard you can talk to, persuade, bribe, beat up. Right? All of these things, I think you would agree with me, are things that come readily to mind based on basic logic, your understanding of the world, and the addition of a few simple systems in the game. right? Precisely. So most of these things are things you're familiar with, and even the ones you're not, like, you know, the biotics, which are basically, you know, quote-unquote magic of the world, or, you know, some of the technomancy kind of things. They're all things you can kind of easily plug in and modify and know pretty quickly. You can get a grasp what these things do, what these things don't do. And you play through and you get a good story in general, and you get good dialogue and nice characters. Now, this is where the adventure game breaks down, basically right at the beginning. Because remember, I was talking a lot about a consistent rule set, and adventure games don't have a consistent rule set. And you never play an adventure game like any kind of normal, sane, or even insane person would play.
Would act. Yeah.
Right? You wouldn't act this way, right? And now, you know, a lot of you are going to be saying, wait a minute, but we're not sociopaths shooting everyone. Well, yes, okay, that's true. But you can think of what sociopaths
are
like.
Well, see, those games where you say, I'm a sociopath shooting everyone, those are still, like, internally consistent.
Right.
Yeah.
You're consistently a sociopath, and oftentimes you're at war anyway.
Most of the time the problem you're solving is those people are trying to make you dead, and you want to make them dead.
Dead.
And the solution you have is you shoot them.
Yeah. Right, or stab them or set them on fire. So in adventure game, you go into a room, your first thing you're going to do is you're going to touch everything because you need to find out what's interactable. And because graphics are limited and even new adventure games haven't fixed this problem, there's no good way to tell what's interactable. So you just start running around like a really spastic blind person or something, trying to figure out what's interactable in the room.
I will interject with you and say that some recent adventure games have ditched that by just like letting you press a button and highlight all the interactable objects in a room.
Wow. Innovation.
I know, right? Yeah. Also, the thing is that it's not really a very active field in terms
of design. No, it's died for all the reasons that I'm going through.
Yes.
So that's the first problem. What's interactable? Apparently now some genius has figured out I should highlight things. But that's apparently gone way too long. And you know, a lot of RPGs from the 90s and 2000s had some kind of highlight and tell you it was interactive. So the fact that that's a new development, really, you don't get any points back adventure games. Because Baldur's Gate had that same freaking highlighting system in like, you know, 98 or something.
Yeah.
You know, so why doesn't Monkey Island?
Oh, yeah. And see, that's a very fair criticism because it's hiding difficulty. It's not making a puzzle that's difficult to solve because it's difficult to solve. It's making a puzzle that's difficult to solve because you didn't realize you could pick up that feather on the desk three rooms
ago. Yes, exactly. They're not making something that's hard and fair. They're trying to cheat and take something that's crappy, but make it hard. This is like lazy AI programming. But wait, there's more. There's a lot of times in adventure games where, again, because they're cheating on the difficulty and because of my point three, where they're not going to tell you the significance of something right away. So once you've figured out what's interactable, probably by mashing your face on it, you're going to pick up everything in the room because apparently you have a limited inventory space. And you're going to put all this stuff in the room because you don't know what is going to be helpful later. And because half the time you get three rooms later and, oh, you needed that feather, but the door is locked for some silly reason, even though it wasn't before and you can't get it. Sucks for you. I hope you saved. Mm-hmm. Again, this isn't legitimate difficulty. They're not being clever. They're not forcing you to think. They're forcing you to play like a schmuck. Which brings me to a third problem, the biggest problem, the real problem. There is no consistency. There is an adventure game puzzle, and I'll put a name of the game in the notes or something, but where you have to disguise yourself as this guy to obtain the last moped in town or some nonsense like that.
I think I know which one you're talking about, but carry on.
Yes, okay. Now, the man in question does not have a mustache, but your disguise needs to have a mustache. Now, again, I'm not sure if this is incompetent programmers or lazy programmers or both, but if I'm going to have a disguise and you want me to make a mustache, the dude should have a mustache. Again, we're being cheap about the difficulty here and shortchanging you because this isn't something a reasonable person would say. For example, Tom Brady does not have a mustache.
No, he does not.
If you were going to disguise yourself as him, there's a lot of things you'd work on. Your hair, that face. But a mustache wouldn't be one of them.
No, it's in fact, it's guaranteed to make you look less like Tom.
Right, so if a guy walks up to a desk in New England and says, hi, I'm Tom Brady. I packed my car in half it square. I'm looking for a donut. Right? You're going to be like, you're not, and he's got a mustache on. You're going to be like, you ain't no Tom Brady.
I saw him last Sunday.
Yeah, he was great. And a quarterback. And not mustached. So that's the first problem. Then the second problem is, well, for a mustache, you need some kind of fake hair. And the game developers want you to take a piece of tape and put it above a mouse hole and then make a cat chase a rat through it so some of the cat hair will get stuck to the tape. Now, has anyone in their minds ever played with a cat or with tape or had a cat get into some tape or gotten tape on arms of some of them or their friends who has hair on them or gotten tape stuck in their own hair on their head. Apparently, these are game developers who live on some weird tapeless, catless island in the South Pacific. And they've lived there their entire lives because they have no experience with this stuff. Okay, because one, yes, you can chase a cat. It won't go where you want it to. That is impossible, ladies and gentlemen. That's an actual real-world puzzle that doesn't work. Mythbusters tested it, confirmed it. Can't make cats go where you want. Two, if a cat runs by some tape, the tape is going to go on the cat. Three, even if you do later find that tape or manage to separate it from the cat, it will have a couple strands of cat hair on it, and you will get clawed for your trouble. None of which is going to get you any closer to making your ridiculous fake mustache that you don't need. And I'm not quite sure how you're supposed to figure this out other than by randomly combining all of the items that you've picked up so far in the world, which are, let's remind you, all of the items you've discovered so far in the world, until you figure out which two or four or ten solve the stupid puzzle you're on. We're not being difficult, we're challenging your ability to pound letters on the key. Here's a related way to do it. I like crossword puzzles a lot. And I'm a big fan of the New York Times crossword puzzle because they're challenging. And it has a nifty little checking feature, which is sometimes helpful if you're not sure of something or if you're having trouble. Now, strictly speaking, if I wanted to play this like a schmuck, I could press, you know, there's every square has 26 combinations. I could check, you know, each single square until I found the letter and systematically eliminate all of it. But that would be no fun. That would be tedious and boring. And if I liked tedious, boring work, I would do something like, I don't know, accounting. Because at least as an accountant, I'm getting paid for my tedium. So here we have a system which is, as far as I can tell, designed to create fake difficulty by making no sense whatsoever and then proceeding not to tell you how to play it. Mm-hmm. Getting to the game I played, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, I can't complain about the graphics too much because it is the late 80s. I can complain about not highlighting what's interactable or some way signifying how I should know. Who can I talk to that will actually have a conversation with me? You don't know. What can I pick up? You don't know. Click around and find it. Exactly. Jay's making clicking motions. That's what you do. That's how you play the game. There's a sequence in the opening where you're supposed to learn how, the fighting system. They don't actually tell you what any of the controls are. There's no tutorial in the game at all. Not even like a little help screen.
But when's this from?
88.
Well,
89.
That's more of failing the games industry at the time. In the late 80s, they expected you to have, well, number one, to have the manual, and number two, to also read the manual.
Right, yes, exactly. Not really. So setting that aside, right, because maybe we have to blame the games industry for that. We can't blame this for, you know, like bad graphics. Mm-hmm. The controls make no sense. You have an attack high, middle, low, and attack high, middle, low are buttons 9, 6, and 3 on your numpad. And then you have two different blocking techniques, 8, 5, and 2, and 7, 4, and 1. Again, high, middle, low for block type 1 and 2. Which one is not very Indiana Jones because he tends to get punched in the mouth a lot.
And, you know, I can't imagine. Can you picture a time when he, like, actually blocked a punch?
No, or really moved. If there's a punch, the guy, he's going to eat it.
Your standard Indiana Jones fist fight is a very, like, I'm going to stand and throw a punch at you, and I might hit you and I might not. Yeah. But then it's your turn. You get to punch me.
Right, exactly. And it's kind of like a duel in that it's all about the puncher's ability to throw a punch good and not the punchee's ability to block or dodge or otherwise get out of the way and be unsporting about it. And it's a ridiculously clunky fight system that doesn't really make any kind of sense. And I'm not a huge fan of fighting games, but I can see the appeal. And at least the base system there is like two or three different attack buttons, and that's it. And then you rack them up with combos and movement buttons. But the fundamentals are simple, as opposed to this, where the fundamentals are ridiculous, and apparently I'm supposed to do something with this? Thank you, no. So there we go. It's a genre that's dead for a damn good reason. Every so often I see someone try to resurrect it, and I really don't know what they're drinking.
It hasn't worked yet.
No, it hasn't.
Even with geniuses of the field, like Tim Schafer.
Yeah, yeah. He can't do it.
Yeah.
And if Tim Schafer can't do it,
I think it's just we've kind of moved past that because you can do
Right, basically
game,
the same
you can do
thing.
A game with puzzles that makes more sense right. in like the role-playing game format.
Exactly, and that gives me the story too that some old adventure games had a, right. a quote-unquote good story.
I will. So there was a there's an adventure game called Broken Sword: Shadow of the Templars, which is yeah. the only adventure game that they've ever drawn me in on a, on story grounds, and I quit because it has a ridiculous puzzle about midway through.
Right.
So what's like the only actual contract in the point-and-click adventure game? That contract is you. Point at something on the screen, you click it and then something happens.
Right.
It may be nothing or maybe something. Right. But that's yeah. like
but
that's it.
I click on something.
That's when time passes. Except right. in this one puzzle where you're trying to get past something guarded by an angry goat.
Right.
And unlike every other puzzle in like every other puzzle game up to that point, it's timing based.
Right.
Like you've got to distract the goat and then while the goat is distracted, run past.
Right.
Which is ridiculous because that's not the way the puzzle games work. Anyway, that's
That's exactly it. Like once again, we're creating fake difficulty by breaking the rules we've carefully established. And again, you're right. That is the only rule is that I click on something and something happens. And if something must happen, I must click on it.
Right.
Right.
Well, and then like whatever happens finishes, and then you can try right. something else.
Well, and going back to the fight example, even though the fight engine was terrible, I had to click on the boxing coach. Mm-hmm. Select fight, you know, click fight option from the dialogue tree, and then I fight. And then I'm in the fight, and then, I mean, other than quitting,
yeah.
I can win or lose, and then I can get on with clicking on other things.
Right.
So it's like an extended action.
You've built a second,
yeah.
like a kind of a sub-game almost.
Right, yeah. exactly.
Anyway.
But no, breaking the rules is terrible, yeah. and that's, I can't stand it. You like, if you want to make a hard puzzle, look at COGS or something, because that actually has puzzles that are tricky and make you think in clever ways rather than just high difficulty behind smoke and mirrors.
We really need to get on to our third topic.
We really do. All right, so enough about games that suck. Don't buy those.
Well, we've got a... So we do some a fair bit of firearms-related reading, the two of us.
Yep.
And one of the topics that comes up an awful lot is like pistol qualification things, yep. like the courses of fire that your police officers or perhaps your feds
yeah.
or whatnot shoot to right. prove that they are in fact qualified to carry a weapon.
Right.
And there's a huge number of sources out there on interesting pistol qualifications, some of which are very hard and some of which are, I would say, like moderately hard.
Right.
And some of which are
And let's give some, let me just cut yeah. in here and get a couple examples. So again, most agencies have a qual. Not all of them are in easy to find place. So the Ohio police qual, I really like. I think we both really
yeah,
like because it's a tricky, but it's reasonable difficulty. Again, this is for regular, you know, Ohio cops. So no special yeah. SWAT
well,
guys.
It's within reach.
Yeah.
Within reach for your average cop and also within reach for your kind of like...
average
recreational
shooter.
Yeah.
So it doesn't take a lot to do. It doesn't take a lot of bullets to go through. It tests basically everything you might be reasonably called upon to do, reasonably expected to do with a handgun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really nice that way. If you want a tougher qual, look at some of the FBI quals are actually quite good. And then the best I've found in terms of difficulty is the Air Marshal qual because it's just horribly mean in terms of harsh penalties for... It's very easy to fail out with the Air Marshal qual.
Well, that's... sensible.
I mean, I wonder why.
That's a really hard environment to shoot in.
Yeah. So there's good reason. The original Air Marshal qual, which I think they eventually got rid of because it ended up being too hard to get enough Air Marshals. Mm. But the idea there in terms of really testing your pistol shooting, same idea. Though, again, because it's Air Marshals, it's a little more limited than the Ohio one. But it really focuses on a lot of tough shots. Doesn't take a lot of bullets to do. And it's a great... And I've got a couple other like drills that could be used in kind of a qual-like way.
Right.
But let's stick to the classic police quals.
So we have our... pistol quals.
Yep.
And like we're saying, there are tons of them out there and you can find one for pretty much anything you want to do.
Yep.
What's very hard to find is a good qualification, like a good qualification course of fire for the practical carbine.
Right.
And so by practical carbine, we mean your AR-15 or AK or any other like modern,
yeah,
like modern intermediate or smaller cartridge.
Yeah. It's an intermediate yeah. cartridge. It's... You know, probably got some kind of optic on it. I mean, not necessarily, but probably. It's got a reasonably high capacity feeding device.
Right. Now, the idea with a qual is, of course, to test you on the things you might be reasonably expected to do.
Right.
And I think it's, well, let's talk about what we're planning on doing with this segment. We're planning on trying our hand at designing a little carbine qualification, which we will then proceed to shoot and see if we've done a good job at designing it or not.
Right. Yep.
So anyway. What you're trying to do with a qualification is test your proficiency at skills you should be reasonably expected to have.
I actually want to cut in here for a second. Let's back up a second.
Yeah.
Though we might want to deal with this later, some totally cool. Also, folks, we're ad-libbing this completely.
Yes.
Lots of fun. What do you want to bring up now or later what gun you would shoot the qual with?
I'll bring that up later.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough. Later.
Yeah.
No, it's cool.
Yeah.
No, it's like a totally ad-lib. Sort
of.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, and so with a carbine, you have a couple of skills you might be expected to have.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll say, like, what we'll call room clearing.
Right.
Shooting quickly at short ranges in confined spaces.
Right.
Now, because it is also a long arm, you could reasonably expect it to, you know, make a shot at maybe, what, 100 to 300 yards with it.
Yeah.
That's, like, that's within reason for, like, use cases with your carbine.
Right.
And the trouble is, I don't think it's super easy to design something that works for those as well as with as well as pistol quality, because the, like, the what's the variance in, like, the type of thing you do with a pistol is much smaller than what you can do with a carbine.
Right.
So anyway, I think we'll just kind of, like, throw open the floor and
okay. Well, let's see. So things I think that we'd want to make sure we have. I do want at least one on the clock reload sequence.
Right. Yeah. I think that's important generally.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, you do want something that tests a reload. You only really need to do it in, like, one bit that's a reload thread. So there's a reload drill, like a two shoot, two load two kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the downloaded mag. That's because reloads aren't super common.
Yeah.
But it's...
Well, I like the idea of doing that at longer range too, because you usually have more control. Like, we'll say, well, it's just, it stands to reason.
Yeah.
When you're in a smaller venue, say, like, if you're, if you're going through a house, you have a lot... Like, there are fewer opportunities to shoot unless your house is, like, seriously being invaded by, I don't know, ninjas or something.
A lot of ninjas. Yeah. Army of ninjas.
So anyway, well, it's a good thing it's an army, otherwise they, like, they'd be really good, each one of them.
Right. Yes, exactly. Distributing the skill.
Yeah, so when you're working your way through a small venue, you're likely to not run your magazine out. If you're doing shooting at longer ranges, you're going to be missing more, just as a matter of course, and you're more likely to have to do that
range. Yeah, so, I feel like a 50-yard... Like, start with two in the mag, you know, so chamber on the clock, and then on the clock, two, reload, and then do a reload, and then shoot two more.
Yeah.
Would be like a 50 yard or 70, like somewhere in that, like, that middling range where I feel like a bunch of the test is going to be at.
I think we should also, we were talking about this earlier, we should also keep the range at 100 yards and in, because that's reasonably doable on any outdoor range you might come across.
And I might have the one thing I would do, because I know you were going to want to do some more range than that. I might do a half-size IP-6 steel at 100, like a full and a half-size IP-6 steel at 100, and then probably not do transitions because that's
right. Well, so that's tricky. Yeah, that covers something else.
Have a drill with a full-size IP-6 steel or some other kind of target at 100, but do a smaller.
Well, so I like the idea. I like the idea at, like, at 100 yards of having, like, you're saying, a full-size IP-6 steel, and then, like, the 8-inch pie plate.
Oh,
drill.
The 8-inch pie plate's a good one too. Yeah.
So, like, so you've got your fast shooting at 100 yards.
Mm-hmm.
With on the steel, more or less. Then you have your precision shooting at basically whatever range by hitting that 8-inch plate.
And I really like, it doesn't work as well up close, but I really like steels in general for these kind of quals because...
Reactive.
Exactly. One is reactive. Two, I think there's a lot of stuff. Sometimes you get preoccupied with inconsequential increments.
Mm-hmm.
So Cooperism, folks, you should look up because it's one of the best things he said, mindset-wise. Got lots of good mindset stuff. But so you get obsessive with, like, you know, am I in the 8 ring or the 10 ring? And really on a qual, it's a, are you in or are you out?
Yeah.
And a big hunk of steel is a great way to say, and if you size it right, there's your in or out. If you rung it, you're in.
Good, yeah.
That's a good shot.
Okay, so I think how many stages in this course fire do we want? Like 5 to 7 is a usual number.
Yeah, I think
we've already got three well-defined ones.
Right.
Well, three well-defined generally. So you have at 50 yards, a load two, shoot two, reload, shoot two.
Right.
Drill. At 100 yards, so we'll just keep it with like 4 rounds per stage, I guess. That seems like a reasonable count.
Yeah.
So we've got your standing steel at 100 yards, and you've got your, I don't know, either kneeling or possibly in position of choice.
Yeah.
8-inch pie plate at 100 yards.
Yeah, I might go with that.
So there's three. There obviously there should be at least one thing fairly close in the test, your transition side to side.
Right, like a short range 10-yard or so pair of targets.
Like 30 degrees apart, say.
Yeah, yeah, just do like a quick transition.
1-2, 1-2.
Yeah. Then maybe back again or something. I don't know. Get both through. I don't know. No, 1-2, 1-2 is probably good.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. We might
actually I kinda like the idea of more at a shorter range. Like maybe I like the idea of having to transition both directions.
So. Yeah.
Shoot two, transition, shoot two, transition, shoot two.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's 4 stages.
Right.
So we've got something at close range, something at medium range, the reload, and two things at long range. Yeah. I feel like we should probably add something else at shortish range, like the 20 to the 10 to 20 yard range.
20 yards, you want to do something with cover? Now, I want to be careful with cover, because there's a skill that's going to come up. Someone's going to mention in the comments, I'm sure, that I don't think is actually quite relevant.
Well,
but let's talk about this. So you have cover, right?
Well, so I guess are we assuming the start position for this is at like low ready for each of these stages?
Yeah, in general, I'm assuming like some kind of low ready. And folks,
on the shooter's choice stage, it'll be like,
yeah,
if you're maybe lay it out per position, but like kneeling, yeah, you can still have a low ready. Prone, you feel like off to the side or something.
Right. Yeah, and with the exception of prone, like actual low ready, I was at a gun school, and there's a lot of times when we did a quote unquote low ready, and most of the guys had their sights like at the bottom of the target.
Yeah,
we're just totally.
No, I think for low ready, you should be like a kind of a 30 degree down angle.
Yeah, a good safe down direction.
Your firearms instructor should not yell at you if he sees you doing it.
Exactly. Now, and if you prefer high ready, you can substitute that. But again, a good safe up direction.
Yeah.
And not, you know, we don't want you pointing at the target. No cheating. So I feel like you're going to start, kind of up for all of them. And so I do kind of like the idea of working with cover, because cover is kind of tricky.
Yeah.
Though it doesn't really need to be necessarily. It could just be like, you know.
Yeah. I like the idea. We'll say most ranges have like a post or something, right? Mm-hmm. Like in the thing, or you can like find some sort of vertical thing to lean around. So here's my thinking for it. So you start at low ready with your body fully behind or on whatever you're defining as the cover side.
Right.
You go
cover.
Yeah. You go around its strong side, because unless you practice an awful lot, if your cover is weak, you're going to go around that strong side.
Exactly. That was what I was going to get at earlier. Is that I don't want to do the one thing I really didn't want to be careful not to do with the weak side is the cover is the transition to weak side shooting to roll out from a weak side cover, because you won't do it.
Yes. You're just going to lean out further and shoot it.
Right. That's what you're going to do. And the reason for that is because there's one person in the world that you cannot lie to. That's your subconscious self. Your subconscious knows what you can and can't do. And it doesn't mean, and, you know, so if you did it once in a class for an evolution, that doesn't count as having mastered it. Your subconscious knows that, so your subconscious will say, let's lean out a little more and get the shot that we know we can make.
Right. I'll interject briefly to say that in the competition I did with the British kit, I practiced all of my revolver shooting in single action using my strong thumb to pull the hammer back, which of course necessitates breaking your sight picture and everything. And when I was there, I got a tip from revolver shooter saying, if you use your weak side thumb, then you can keep the gun keep the gun on target and you'll shoot faster. I thought that's a really good idea. I should start doing that. And I did not in competition a single time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's not just.
Well, it's like I'd practiced the other way, like, you know, 300 times.
Yep, that's right. Yeah. He got comfortable with it. His subconscious knows, I can do this on demand, on the clock, when, you know, there's stress, right? So, exactly. Yeah. So, yes, you have another idea, but you'd have to break yourself of it. So, that's something you might revisit sometime in the future.
I like the idea of you're going around the strong side of your cover.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I mean, you could do the cover the other way too. It's just lean further. Don't switch shoulders because you won't.
I think I like the idea of sticking with just one direction, though, because that takes away a lot of the variance in what cover people have. So like you can do it with a post by staying on the cover side of the post and leaning around just as well as you could if you've got like a barrel.
Right. Yep.
So there's five stages.
Yep.
Well, what do I want to do for round count? I like the idea of putting a transition in that cover one. Like two on a 10-yard target, two on a 20-yard target, maybe.
Yeah, that might work good.
Maybe like you got to come around the target some.
Yeah,
come around the cover some.
Yeah, though a bunch of things that you want to do there, you really need like a better cover obstacle.
Yeah.
Right. I guess
you've got like draw a line from the from the cover at 10 yards. Put one. I don't know. Say like what 30 degrees to the left.
Yeah.
At 20 yards. Put one 30 degrees to the right.
Yeah.
Engage the 20-yard first. Come around. Engage the 10-yard.
Yeah. Exactly. But and then make. I don't want to get this into an IDPA discussion of tactical order, but make it kind of clear which one should be engaged first. Just reasonably, if you roll out, this is the guy you're going to see first. That's the guy you're going to see second.
Don't expose yourself unnecessarily.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Right, you know, shoot the first guy you see, then the second one. You know, kind of a little bit of pieing, but nothing too crazy. Right, this is supposed to be simple.
Yeah. I think that's an important skill that we capture there. So we've got one very close range stage, one. Mm-hmm. Close range stage with cover, one medium range stage with reload, and two long range stages to test your speed and accuracy in different things.
Right, and again, the accuracy...
What's our round count here? We've got four at the four on the cover stage, six on the other ones. There's
on the
10.
Close hoser, yeah. Yep.
Four at 50 yards. There's what, 14.
Yep.
Then I guess four the other two. So there's what, 22.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, we should really get like the last eight. So if you, you know, a 30.
A 30, yeah. Well, we can just tack another, another, what's it called? Another, another two rounds onto all the ones that have four.
Yeah, we could do that. I mean, you might also do like a, something with 20 yards, like a really harsh par time snapshot kind of thing.
Hmm. No, right. That's like, that's a good
right. Record. So like, so you start from your low ready standing. And then, you know, you got a target at 20 yards, right? And then you can, and there's a bunch of different ways you could do it, but something like, you know, you have a strict par up shoot or up double, you know, yeah. Two or whatever.
I like up two, and that gives us
pop, pop.
Yeah. Well, we'll nail down the round cut and everything later. I think we've got a pretty good idea of what we want to do with this.
Yeah, something like that. And I think that, because I think that covers about everything you do with the rifle. It's a little, it's actually kind of reasonably spread, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the pistol quals are, you know, always short-range bias because the pistol has kind of a short-range bias.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, we did cover, I don't think there's a big need to stress a bunch of weird shooting positions.
Yeah. Well, like, you get your choice of your long-range shooting position right. At the long-range target. Yeah. I think that's
good enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, we'll knock out par times and like the final round count and mm-hmm. the final like descriptions of the courses of fire in a soapbox post, I think.
Yeah. And, we'll, and we might have to do like kind of a before and after, like this is what we think is good. Go run it.
Yeah.
God,
kind of, oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But so something like that seems about right feel wise in terms of, you know, meeting our goal of testing everything. You might be reasonably qualified to do with a carbine and not imposing extreme hardship in terms of requiring a lot of stuff you might not have, because right. Lots of ranges
don't have a lot of stuff.
Suck.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that's very important that you yep. can, like, you can do it all with simple stuff.
Right. Yeah. And you can substitute paper. It's just, you know, yeah. more annoying.
I'll find a place that sells like, you know, full size IPSC paper targets.
Oh, the cardboard ones are better.
Oh, well,
they're tougher.
Full size cardboard. I guess we should order those.
Yeah. Those are easy. Those are cheap. Those yeah. are super.
All right. So that's,
oh, wait. No, we're not done yet. No. I'm not letting you off the hook. What gun are you using for your qual?
I'm going to take, I think I'm going to take the ARC.
The ARC?
Yeah.
Okay. Why?
I like the sight the most.
Okay.
I think
weird. I expect you to be like an AK guy or your bullpup thing. Yeah. And
well, plus there's a reload stage here. That's easier.
Oh, yeah. You're right. The AR reload's a lot easier.
The bullpup's actually, I think, probably easier than the AK in terms of...
Really?
Well, because the SKS bolt stays back when it's
right,
empty.
Yeah. It's got the last round hold open.
Yeah, okay. So that's just like whack it against your shoulder and it'll close.
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm clearly going AR. I'd probably actually do... not sure what mods you're going to get, but my 6920 with a red dot.
Mm.
Yeah. And I'm not sure what I'm doing with the handguard there. I've gone back and forth a lot, so...
Yeah. Well, again, I'm sure that'll all be in the other wrap-up post probably the January podcast.
Yeah, and there'll probably be a post or two about, like, what I did to my Colt and why. So not really much point in boring people with it at the moment.
We can bore them with it later.
Exactly!
Anyway, on that note, you have wasted another perfectly good hour-ish. And I were yeah. in, what, an hour and 3 minutes listening to us... Babylon. I feel like we were more entertaining this time than we've been in the past.
Yeah, it's been a good one.
The especially with the games topic. That was a good
like that was a good solid, you know, yeah. good one. But yeah, so thanks for listening. Crossbox Podcast is produced by myself, John, my co-host, Jay. And it's brought to you by Many Words Press, online at manywords.press. Our theme music is Royal Rumble by Jay Mann of rmusicbox.com and is used under the terms of the Creative Commons Attributions License. Keep up with us, the Crossbox contributors, between podcasts at soapbox.manywords.press. And we don't have any guests, so I don't need to worry about thanking those idiots.